All right, so this is Larry Johnson of the New Media Consortium, and it is my great pleasure to introduce the speaker for this next session. Jared Bendis is Creative Director of New Media at Case Western Reserve University. He also works a great deal with museums in the Cleveland Museum of Art and Virtual Reality. He is a presenter that has been at NMC conferences and events many, many times, and I know that all of you will very much enjoy what he has to say about the unexpected artist and the critic. So, with no further ado, take it away, Jared.
Well, thank you very much, Larry, and you just killed my first line. No, I'm kidding. Hi, my name's Jared Bendis, and this is the Unexpected Artist and Critic. We live in an ocean of media. This ocean is wide, and this ocean is deep, and we've created many tools to help us navigate it. These tools allow us to choose what we watch and where we watch, but not why we watch. What we need is a compass, and that compass is a vocabulary of criticism and of a new media literacy that we can use to navigate this ocean effectively and efficiently. Every day this ocean gets a little deeper. We're drowning in media, and we keep adding water. To survive, we must embrace our roles as both artist and critic. And as we talk about media and new media literacy, we might be tempted to jump right in and talk about media creation. After all, doesn't creation come first? Shouldn't we discuss how you paint a painting and only then discuss what it looks like? And while it might appear that this is the order of things, the reality is much more complex. In truth, we are not talking about one specific painting, but all paintings, the intrinsic concept of what a painting is. Imagine enrolling in a painting class having never seen a painting. Before you could paint anything, you would need to understand more about what paintings are to survey the possibilities of what a painting could be. Let me push this idea even further. Could you write a book having never read one? Now the initial notion seems absurd. The order we discuss must be conceptual. First comes observation, and only then creation. Now, when I was getting my master's in art education, I was required to take a series of studio courses at the Cleveland Institute of Art. At the time, I didn't know how to draw and had never taken a drawing course, and I begged my advisor to not make me take one. So instead, he signed me up for a printmaking course with a focus on lithography. It was exciting. I was going to make lithographs. It never occurred to me that I had no real idea of what a lithograph was. And by that, I mean I knew it was a form of art, that it was something you looked at. I knew it was something you reproduced. That's the nature of printmaking. But I hadn't looked at a print. If I had, it might have occurred to me sometime before the first class, also known in grad school as the point of no return, that to make a print, you have to draw something first. The next semester, I took a course in the history of prints at the Cleveland Museum of Art. And every day, they brought us into the print room and showed us original etchings, engravings, woodblocks, and lithographs. It was inspiring. I had no idea what the medium could do. In the end, my education was out of order. I needed to see, then to do. How many of us are doing without seeing? And I still don't know how to draw. And this does not get you an A in grad school. This, however, does. Now, I'm not showing you this because I think it's cool. I'm showing it because I didn't draw it. Instead, I applied my knowledge of computer graphics and hand-laid every pixel. In this example, I applied my knowledge of vector-based graphics to hand-cut the linoleum block. But does my experience limit my creativity? Does it hinder it? Does it define it? People often talk about thinking outside the box. Can we learn to be creative inside it instead? Things change. It's the only truth in the world. Alan Kay is quoted as saying that technology is anything that was invented after you were born. It's not a bad metric, though regardless of your age, it tends to make you feel old. There are many ways of dividing the world. There are major events that are common to our lifetime. You either remember the moon landing or you weren't born yet. There are personal events, like what song you listened to in high school, which have more to do with measuring your influences and experiences than an absolute timeline. A friend of mine once told me that the older you get, the more pop icons you lose. You know more names and more of them die. It's a constant feeling of expansion and contraction. And these icons aren't just people. My wife came home the other day and told me how sad she was that the local drive-in theater was being torn down. We've never been to it. We've never even talked about going to it. Why would she care? It's a marker, and we hate these when these markers disappear. And it goes beyond people and places. It even applies to ideas. Think of the frustration felt by one generation as their life-changing moments are looked upon by the next generation as unoriginal and trite. A classic example is from Star Wars. What's the relationship here? Well, in 1977, it's hero and villain. But in 1980, it's father and son. And it's more than that. The idea that Darth Vader is Luke Skywalker's father was big news, a big secret. For a generation of filmgoers, the surprise was monumental. It was the concept that defined the trilogy, the catalyst that took you from point A to point B. But for the next generation, the secret wasn't a revelation at all, but foundational material for the prequel trilogy. The younger generation scoffs at us and asks, how could you have been fooled by such a simple device? And we might respond, at the time it wasn't. We must remember that at one time we too asked the same questions of the generation before us. How do we address this moving target, this rolling generation gap? Is this a gap of language or a gap of concept? Is it merely enough to acknowledge it and move forward? Can we identify the markers that define our lives? What about the lives of others? Might all this just be our inability to properly analyze and verbalize our own true meanings? Once upon a time, everything was unique. Everything in the world was a one-of-a-kind, a painting, a table, a book, even a musical performance. To have two identical items was the rarity. Each item had its own flavor, its own subtleties. And along with each item came a personal history of skill and experience. You have to look back at a poorly authored but handwritten book and ask, why was this important enough for someone to spend the time and effort? Today's ability to make many copies of garbage is only a reflection on someone's ability to press a button. Today's items have no soul. What does Gregorian chant sound like? Do we really know? We have a system, we have rules, we have a theory, and we apply that intelligently to create a performance. But what if in reality it sounded a lot different in the 9th century? A more recent example is Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. I've always loved the work. In fact, Bernstein's 1959 performance pretty much lives on my turntable. But a friend of mine once had me listen to Gershwin's own 1924 recording. Not just the speed, but the whole tone was different. And it occurs to me that the differences come down to an evolution of media. Media can slowly change and transform over time. Can you imagine what this work will sound like in another 1,000 years? Well, you don't need to, because it probably won't be any different. And we can blame recorded music on that. The mass distribution of identical copies tends to codify and solidify the right version or the right approach. If all I heard were live performances, then the nuances would be the tradition, the evolution would be part of the experience, and the world would benefit from the change. Not just change, but the ability to change. Don't get me wrong. There are people doing amazing things out there. When Danger Mouse remixed the Beatles' White Album with Jay-Z's Black Album, he was defying this convention and pushing forward. And I'm not talking about copyright issues. That's a whole different can of worms. I'm talking about the ability to think past the lockdown versions, to still feel the original book after you've seen the movie. So how do we put the soul back in our media? Can we advance our current value systems by harkening back to a time when the scarcity of items and experiences strengthened their worth? Should we go to more concerts, plays, musicals, visit more museums? Should we try and remove the virtual from our life? Or do we need to add something to the virtual to make it more meaningful? Methods of mass production, such as movable type, other forms of printmaking, and interchangeable parts, were a revolution not just of distribution, but also of the conceptual division between content and experience. It enabled the virtual experience. At one point in time, the only way to hear a piece of music was to go and hear it performed. And what you heard was different every time. Content and experience were bound together, and that relationship was significant. Imagine now in our modern times, the difference between watching a film at an IMAX theater, a regular movie theater, at home on DVD, at home on cable or satellite, on YouTube, on your iPod video, or here in virtual reality. The content is stable, some could argue identical, and it's only the experience that varies. By what metrics do we measure the experience versus the content? What is the value system of our threshold of experience? Are there generational differences? Am I just too old because I don't like to watch TV shows on an iPod? Is it a weakness that I prefer the immersive nature of a movie theater, or really a strength that I can let myself be transported by media? Has mass distribution lowered our threshold of experience? Do we accept less quality for better availability? A friend of mine once told me we were going to see an ABBA concert. And as the concert date approached, I realized that I hadn't seen an announcement for ABBA in the newspaper. On the way to the concert, she told me that we weren't going to see ABBA, but the group Bjorn again, the ABBA Experience, a cover band. Now, this probably sounds like a nightmare on many, many levels, but in fact, it was interesting. Here was a band that specialized in giving the audience the experience of an ABBA concert. It was fun, it was playful, it sounded good. While I can't tell you I've seen ABBA live, I probably know what it would have been like. And as you sit there and roll your eyes, is there any difference in going to a Renaissance fair or medieval dinner? A few years later, when I was in Finland, I found out that the real ABBA was still on tour. Would that experience have been better? Would the performance have been better? I'm not asking you to compare an ABBA cover band in 2000 with the real ABBA in the 1970s. I'm asking you to compare ABBA 30 years after their prime to a cover band that is devoted to recreating that prime. Now, it all depends on whether you value the content or the experience, or better yet, the interdependent combination of the two. We've all seen pirated movies on the internet. Some people download them to keep them, to create a collection like others collect DVDs. My threshold for quality is too high, which is funny because I listen to records. And while my brain can hear the music under the static, it refuses to see the images under the MPEG artifacts. I demand more. I know when I've looked at movies on the internet, it was simply to be tied over until I could buy the right version, the good version, the real version. I've purchased a James Bond movie so many times. I've purchased them on videotape, on DVD, in full screen and widescreen. I know HD is around the corner. My Pink Floyd friends have similar stories about their Dark Side of the Moon albums. We value the content, and along with that valuable content, we want to have a more valuable experience. So how do we raise the bar of both content and experience? And by this I mean, how do we raise the bar of the appreciation of both content and experience? Ubiquity be damned. When we go hear live music, we have to make choices based on certain limitations. There is a limitation of time and timing. When is the concert? How many performances are they given? There is this limitation of space. How many people can attend simultaneously? There was a revolution of synchronous and asynchronous mass media distribution, radio and records, and everything changed again. How have these mediums affected our ability to choose? Did giving us more choices help us find what we wanted? Is there a limit to how many choices are useful, and did we surpass it? I'm always amazed about how people will watch on broadcast television, commercials and all, a movie that is sitting on their shelf. We've all done it. We've all talked about a movie we've seen 50 times on TNT or HBO. Why don't we just pop in the DVD? What is it about this temporal medium, this nonstop flow of information, that is more compelling to us? Or is it simply from the familiarity and laziness? We see another change with time shifting. I love time shifting. My DVR is my friend. I realized how powerful it was when, after only 2 weeks of having a DVR at home, I tried to hit pause on the TV in my office. The sheer power is intense. I can finally hear every word and experience every moment. Because while my home theater isn't as immersive as a movie theater, it doesn't matter because I can keep replaying the scene until I feel I've encoded it the way I want. At first, I was just clever with the DVR. I would pause a 9 p.m. TV show for 15 minutes, and then to start watching it so it would end at 10 p.m. exactly with no commercials. I was reallocating the time according to my rules. But now we've become experts, and in my house, if we think we might want to watch a new show, we record the first few episodes, and if it gets canceled, we delete them without watching them. No disappointing separation anxiety. Does time shifting help or hinder? Are we watching more TV or less? Better TV or worse? How is the tool affecting these choices, and how are we expressing those decisions? Imagine a new restaurant that's just opened and you decide to sample the cuisine. How do you order from the menu? If you see a dish you know, you might order it and then compare it against previous experiences. You might even qualify that experience. The Eggs Benedict at this restaurant weren't as good as another's, but then again, these were half the price. A friend once suggested I try Eggs Benedict with avocado. I said I didn't like avocado. He persisted that I should try it because he felt the texture was a unique sensation. I again repeated that I didn't like avocado. Oh, he said, you mean you dislike avocado. To him, the terms don't like and dislike have different usages, the former passive, the latter active. It's a fascinating distinction. I was pleased with the discovery, not a new vocabulary word, but a new usage, a personal context into which I can place something in the scale of my own experiences. I explained to him that as a fat guy, I don't simply tolerate foods. I either like or I don't like them. And it's that way of thinking that probably made me overweight in the first place. So how do we learn to verbalize our criticisms? What makes something good or bad, right or wrong? How can we exercise and expand our vocabulary? Well, let's start by looking at this picture. I use this image in my multimedia class as a Photoshop quiz. What's wrong with it and how would you fix it? These are two separate questions. First, you have to verbalize, in English, not techno-speak, what is wrong with the photo? It's bad isn't enough. So let's go through it. It has an unnecessary green border, which we need to crop out. His face is too dark, but the background looks all right, so we need to adjust the exposure just on his face. The background is very rotated. This is a hard one to fix because we need to rotate the image some without rotating it too much. And if we rotate it, then we need to crop it again. He also looks a little too orange. Of course, his eyes are closed. How do we fix that? Well, that's simple. We just take another photo. I don't want my students to touch a photo in Photoshop until they can talk about it. I want them to be able to say not just what they like or don't like, but how they might improve on it. To do this, they need to have a vocabulary of design. They need to be able to understand the difference between value and hue. They need to also understand the conventions of design. They need to learn the grammar of the visual world. Yes, it's another system of rules, but we teach our children grammar so they can better express themselves. We want them to wield the tool of language efficiently. They must also wield the tool of visual design. When I was in a painting class as an undergraduate, I remember my painting instructor looking at a work and saying the only way to improve it was to start over. I had drawn a sea painting, and it was going to stay a sea painting. He didn't tell me to start over. He told me to acknowledge it for what it was, move on, and to learn from that experience. I'm always astounded when I go to see a bad movie, and I see a lot of them. I'm astounded how many of them feel like they haven't been proofread, that someone didn't take a step back and tighten things up a bit. But it's funny, because how often when you watch a movie of a musical do you think to yourself, wow, that was the best take, because you know they did several. So when I watch these bad movies, I have to remind myself how bad it probably was before they got it as good as this bad. They rarely start over. They just accept the C. As a media consumer, we should not. Now let's take a look at a real painting. It's Giorgione's The Tempest. If this were an art history class, I would ask you to describe it. Tell me what you see. Tell me what it means. Well, I won't. I could tell you a variety of theories about what it means, and the more theories I told you, the less likely you would have one of your own. And that scares me, because it's fresh ideas that the world needs most. But I'll get back to that. We've turned into a society of choice. We've created so much content that we have a glut of radio stations, TV stations, and movie theaters. The internet is overflowing, and we demand that everything be documented and recorded, and we have access to what we want, when we want, and where we want it. It has created a boom market for DVDs. Who would have thought that a TV show like Charles in Charge would have a new life on DVD? Are our search and time-shifting tools fostering quality? Today's Charles in Charge wouldn't have survived two episodes, wouldn't have found its rhythm or its audience, and it's contradictory, because how do we rebuild a culture that supports the nurturing of ideas when our fleeting dissatisfaction is translated into off with their heads? We all need time to grow, and in many ways the competition is so fierce that it appears that individually we might never succeed. We live in a brave new world of authorship. Education is constantly changing. The knowledge pool is getting larger, and students are being asked to contribute to it. Students are becoming researchers and authors. How does authoring a paper change the nature of its creation? How important to education is public speaking and presenting? Who defines these new standards, and how do we make sure the teachers know how to evaluate the new media, let alone teach it? Does an education of authorship better prepare students for their post-educational life? And do trends in new media even have a place in education? I ask a lot of questions, and I'm not ready to answer them. We've all been to an art gallery and heard somebody say, "What's the big deal? I could do that." And I always respond, "But you didn't." We don't value the ideas as much as we value the implementation. Thinking is not the same as doing. It's not enough. The other day, my friend Tom and I were talking about making a movie. We're always talking about this. And I said, "Then what's wrong with us? We have this desire, the equipment, the ideas. I mean, look at us. We have means, motive, and opportunity. Where's the murder?" So we had to reevaluate what we really have. Do we have the means? Maybe. We have access to the technology, sure, but are we versed enough, not as passive observers, but as active creators, to actually go out and film a movie? We have motive, the desire, but even that can be seen as limited to just talking a good game. And as far as opportunity, we have to make our own opportunities. And the only way to find the time would be when we make the time. It's like a bad novel. No matter how bad it is, it's better than mine because I haven't written one. With the renewed call for new media literacy, we must acknowledge that new media is more than just a medium, more than just a language. It's a competency that required for our very survival. Our first goal should be to level the playing field and then to raise the bar. We must not fall into what I like to call the hammock syndrome. Every night as I lay in bed, I think of myself swinging ever so gently in a hammock. It's paradise. But every time I go to buy a hammock, I find that I don't like the way I feel in one. It's uncomfortable and it's awkward. You see, what I really want to feel is the way that I think other people feel when they lay in a hammock. There is this sense of universal insecurity that everyone else is getting it, and I want to get it like they get it. What I'm saying is that experiences have to be personal. They have to be real. And you need to be aware that it's not enough to embrace the trends. You need to understand the trends. And remember that not everybody likes swinging in a hammock. So who's going to heed the call and lead the charge? And does the charge require leadership or subversion? I want to conclude by going back to an earlier point. It's hard to escape from information. Once a seed is planted, it will grow. It's impossible to unlearn a thing. If I show you the logo for Case Western Reserve University, you might go, that's nice. But once I tell you it's a fat man carrying a surfboard, it's over. That's all you'll see ever again. So do I condone censorship? I've been accused of it recently, and in some ways I don't resent it. I think we need censorship. I think we should censor ourselves. We need to remove from our lives the idea of the one right way. To become a little more jaded so that we can leave our minds open. It's the only way that as creators we can rise above being recyclers. We also need to remove from our lives the bad things. As artists and critics, we should not accept the unacceptable. We need to accept and demand quality and not just create tools to help us get to the good stuff. Tools alone will not be our salvation because gone unchecked, we will drown in the sea of media. Thank you. And now, if anyone has any questions, if you can IM them to me, I would be happy to answer them.
Well, and thank you, Jared.
If anyone has any questions, if you can IM them to me, I would be happy to answer them.
Well, Jared, this is Larry Johnson, and I have a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
I would like for you to tell us a little bit about the work that you're doing in Second Life.
Well, we've got a couple things going on in Second Life. Right now, we actually have a class that is using Second Life. It's a SAGES class. It's a seminar course for first-year K students. And they're using Second Life in their seminar. Interestingly enough, a few years ago, the professor who's using this wanted to use a virtual environment because her class is on computers and society, and it's actually on, like, the virtual self. So we actually set up a MOO for her a few years ago, and her class would meet half of the time in the MOO and half of the time in real life. And they would kind of go back and forth in that. And we've moved forward. Obviously, it's a few years later and a couple of virtual environments later. And now they're doing it in Second Life. And they're meeting and comparing and experiencing what it is like to be a virtual person versus a real person and kind of living it day by day. It's an interesting thing because they're not just talking about it. They're doing it. Another class that we have is a couple of our theater faculty members are possibly interested in using it to talk about stagecraft, not in terms of doing performances per se, but actually in terms of learning how to get on and off stages and learning about sort of the intricacies of what it is like to work in various places. And it's nice because a lot of times they do it, you know, theoretically, and it will be a place for them to do it as a real life experience place. We've got a couple people who have some interesting ideas. Any other questions? Set design, yes. It's a great question. The question was, here we go. What would an art history class that took these ideas to heart look like? Ooh, it's kind of scary because, I mean, some of this is really hearkening back. I was recently invited to give a talk to graduate-level music students on music and technology. And they wanted to know what was out there for them. And the answer was nothing was out there for them. In some ways, the music students were fighting technology because there was nothing there that helped them. But if you look at it from an art point of view, part of it is about kind of rethinking it. I mean, you have to ask yourself. I mean, I think art history does a lot of this. The question isn't what art history would look like. The question is, what would happen if an English class realized that art history and design all have to come together? That there are these three or four major literacies that all belong in the same place.
Jared, this is Larry, and I'm fascinated by the device that you're using to give the presentation. And I wonder if you'd maybe tell us a little bit about the whiteboard and how it works.
Well, so here's the trial story, because he's sitting in the audience. Word had it that I was doing Second Life stuff on campus. Kid walks into my office and says, I'm the best Second Life guy you'll ever meet. So I hired him. And he's got some really interesting ideas, and he's immersed in the environment. And I think that's what's really critical, is I'm looking and I'm working with people who, I would say, live here more than I do. And it's kind of nice. I think you have to look at this from a collaborative sense. But what he's done is he's created for me, obviously I have a slideshow, and there are many slideshow things, but he's also created for me this nice little virtual whiteboard, which I'm about to clear, so I can so that I can put the next person on. And let's see if I can figure out how to do that again. Let's change modes and go back to the virtual whiteboard so I can clear it. Yes, it's in a... Turn a pen mode off. All right, and so now I can actually come over here and I can type something, and it will show up on the whiteboard, which is just a nice way for people to be able to see things. He keeps coming up with new ideas. We should be able to do note cards and stuff so I can help prep. The original idea was that since half of my presentation was simply text and images, and the other were images, I could save a little bit of money on uploading images by using the whiteboard. I have another question here. I'm going to add it to the whiteboard. All right. The question was the use of multimedia in coursework. You know, it's interesting. There are some big problems. How do you teach people to use it? When I work with faculty members, I try to get past the wow factor. I mean, I always ask the question, and I sometimes can be treated very, you know, stared back. What is the pedagogical reason that you're doing this? If you can't answer it, you shouldn't be doing it. When I teach PowerPoint, when I teach anything, if it's not helping, it's hurting you. You have to have a reason for everything. You have to have a purposeful thing. You wouldn't put a comma in a sentence if you didn't have a reason for that comma. Even if you put a comma in wrong, usually there's a reason you put it in there. You think it's the right pause. And the same thing goes with media. So we have to teach media the same way we teach everything else. We have to make sure that it's used for the right reasons, to get past the gee whiz, to get them to realize that it's not gee whiz for everyone else. One of the biggest things I talk about when I give a presentation, or when I teach people how to give presentations, is that your presentation is probably really boring to you. You heard it too much. You know it too well. You have to look through it through the fresh eyes. What is someone else gonna hear when you say it for the very first time? So you don't get that experience again. The aha feeling of, oh my God, I thought of something cool. You never get to hear what other people hear when you relate it to them. And the same thing goes with media. You have to literally put media in that same perspective and put them in the same place.
Well, I think that's a fantastic point, Jared, and I think we're coming to the end of our time here, and so what I'm going to suggest is if you wouldn't mind staying with us for a little while, we'll go ahead and stop the audio channel and move into chat, because mm-hmm. I think the folks in the audience would like to talk with you directly, and I want to thank you on behalf of all of us for a really engaging presentation. Really different than any one that we've had throughout the whole series, and you touched right on the core theme of the symposium, and I want to thank you for that. Jared will also be part of the program for the upcoming online conference that we're having next week on the flat web that continues what we're doing here in the symposium. And so if you'll join me in a round of applause for Jared, we'll then go ahead and move to chat. So thank you very much, Jared.
Thank you, Larry.